From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when Russian President Vladimir Putin released a video explaining why his country has largely stayed out of meddling in the U.S. election. Putin explained that he wanted to mess with the American electorate, but it turns out he didn't have to. He said that Americans are so susceptible to misinformation that we're doing his work for him. It was a devastating message, only it turns out Putin never said it. The video and audio look very real and sound very real, but it's a deep fake. And the company that released it says their goal was to create a message about how vulnerable we are when we see and quickly share video like this. Deepfake uses modern technology, allowing us to create pictures, video, audio that seems real, but isn't. We'll share that Putin video with you in just a moment. You can hear it for yourself. And there have been others. Kellyanne Conway, Barack Obama, Kim Jong-un, all appearing in various ways in various projects that are deepfakes meant to deceive us. Well, that is just one flavor of what the ways that we are susceptible to false information, believing lies, even believing, I hate using the term, but it's fake news. And a new exhibition at Rochester Contemporary Arts Center explores society's grappling with the, what's kind of the post-truth era in some ways. Trust But Verify addresses how so-called fake news is affecting our present and could impact our future. We're going to talk to some of the artists behind these projects about their work and what they hope viewers will learn from it. Let's welcome our guest now. Blue Cease is the curator and executive director of ROCA, Rochester Contemporary Arts Center. Blue, long time no see. Welcome back to the program.
It's been too long, Evan. Thanks for having us on.
Well, it's nice to have you. And nice to have journalist Erica Bryant back with us with Rochester ties and a lot of wise words on these subjects. How are you these days, Erica Bryant?
Doing well, thanks. How are you?
Good. Thanks for making time for the program. Our thanks to Eric Koonsman, who's an artist who is going to talk about some of his contribution here. Eric, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Octavio Abundez is with us. Octavio is an artist as well. Thanks for making the time for us.
Oh, thank you, Evan. Hi to everybody.
Well, first of all, before we really dive into the art side of this, let me just ask the journalist on the panel, Erica Bryant, how concerned are you about whether it's deep fakes or just how susceptible we are to bad information, intentional misinformation? Are we getting any better at this as time goes on, as we use more social media, or you think we're getting worse, Erica?
Well, I think it depends. I think in terms of what people understand about the ability of people to create fake news or to create things that look real or aren't is improving. So people know that not to believe everything you see and not to necessarily believe everything you read. But I think from a cultural perspective, our desire to go along with such stories anyway or such news anyway, just because it sort of reinforces a view we want to have of the world, I think that remains a problem.
Well, I want to listen to some of the examples that we're talking about here that I mentioned right off the top here. First of all, if you had the video is just as good as the audio you're going to hear. It's spot on. It's gripping. If you heard this when you're driving in your car and you heard it as an ad, would you believe that it's fake? This is Vladimir Putin, only it's a deep fake.
America, you blame me for interfering with your democracy, but I don't have to. You are doing it to yourselves. Polling stations are closing. You don't know who to trust. You are divided. There are strings we can pull, but we don't have to. You are pulling them for us.
And as the bell tolls in that, you see a message on the screen that says, "This video is not real, but the message is," urging Americans to be on guard, to protect democracy, and to protect against the spread of misinformation. So it's so gripping that a lot of media outlets have said to the creators of that, we know what you're intended to do, but it looks too real. We're not going to share it. We're not going to do it. Now I want to listen to President Obama, only it is not President Obama. This is actually Jordan Peele the Hollywood writer, director, actor, creator. This is just Jordan Peele's voice. Now, the video is Obama, and it looks pretty good. But if you heard this ad, what would you think?
We're entering an era in which our enemies can make it look like anyone is saying anything at any point in time, even if they would never say those things. So, for instance, they could have me say things like, Killmonger was right, or Ben Carson is in the sunken place, or, how about this, simply, President Trump is a total and complete d-. Now, you see, I would never say these things, at least not in a public address, but someone else would. Someone like Jordan Peele. This is a dangerous time. Moving forward, we need to be more vigilant with what we trust from the internet. That's a time when we need to rely on trusted news sources.
If you saw the video, it's Obama's face and his lips matching that stuff. Jordan Peele, turns out, does pretty good Obama. I think I've heard better. That's pretty good. But the message is the same as the Putin ad. Be careful. Watch out for this stuff. Blue Cease, how does that dovetail with what's happening at Roku? Tell me about it.
Yeah, thanks. Those are terrific examples. And I think, first and foremost, how it dovetails is that the artists and in our exhibition here who are using the deepfake technology, just like the examples that you shared, they're using the deepfake to create a little dissonance in the viewer, perhaps a lot of dissonance. And from there, the message is conveyed, their core message, which the deepfakes in our exhibition here are by two artists, Bill Posters and Daniel Howe, and their primary concern is the increasing role that big data and what some would call surveillance capitalism is having on our life, our politics, our friendships, arguably many, many aspects of our life, and certainly shaping our notions of truth. So all those are examples of how artists and smart campaigns are using the deep fake to kind of have a bit of deep engagement with the viewer, I would say. And then the other two elements of our exhibition also deal with our society's grappling with truth and veracity. And the three elements kind of represent the past, present, and future. The deep fakes really represent the future of our concerns about truth and accuracy in our exhibition. And, on the call today, we have the two artists who are responsible for the past and the present aspects of our exhibition.
Yeah, and we're going to move past the deepfakes in just a second, but I want to make one more important point here. I mean, we're 6 days away from an election, and Erica Bryant, I think one of the reasons this is really timely, to whether it's to see and hear these kinds of messages that the creator of these ads, Jordan Peele, among others, are doing with these deepfakes is, it strikes me that if we are in an election, Erica, that is close, and who knows, this could be very close again, that a deep fake that comes out with 48 hours before the election, let's say it's an 8-second video that someone purported to have taken surreptitiously in a private meeting that shows Donald Trump or Joe Biden saying something horrific, and it comes out and it's grainy and it's 8 seconds long and you go, oh my gosh, I can't believe it's real. Only it's a deep fake. How fast is that thing going to spread? How much impact could it have? And how much time is the media going to need or journalists going to need to sort of debunk it? Because the campaigns will say it's not real. But my feeling is that deep fakes can hurt the most the closer you get to an election. How do you see it, Erica?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And especially when you have people not really being that disposed to truth anyway. Like, even if you debunk a deep fake, people will say that the debunking of the deep fake is fake news. So I think that we're in an environment where you have a lot of false information and you have a lot of people not trusting anything and that doesn't sort of already align with what they want to believe. So I think it's in a very scary moment, and a deep fake like that could come out and certainly influence people when one way or the other.
Yeah,
and I would be surprised if we didn't see one.
Oh gosh, I mean honestly, and you know,
one or more.
Yeah, and you also raise sort of like the parallel point to it, which is that let's say one of those comes out, and then If you like what you see in that video, in other words, if that video helps the political side that you're on, you may be more predisposed to think that the fake news is the debunking because you have motivated reasoning on your side saying, no, this has to be real. I want this to be real. How much do you think, Erica, in the future we need to emphasize and improve the emphasis earlier on helping kids who become adults, helping teenagers, helping everyone understand what motivated reasoning is, understand how we form beliefs, epistemology, and why our beliefs are so difficult to shake once we kind of embed them in our identity? How important? How do we do that?
I don't know.
Solve everything, Erica Bryant.
I cannot. That's above my pay grade.
Do you think we need to be teaching reasoning and epistemology earlier?
Oh, absolutely. 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 And I think media literacy, I think that media literacy should absolutely be an important part of education right now, especially since kids are getting so much information from the internet, and knowing what to believe and what might be considered a trustworthy source, and just knowing that it's important to be able to figure out and analyze who is putting out this information that you're reading, or who made this video, or who made this, news article. Kids definitely need to be thinking about the sources of the information that they're just taking in.
Well, Evan, can I add something
there? Yeah, please. Go ahead, Blue.
I would argue that we're living this right now. I think that the examples that you shared and similarly the artists who made the deepfakes in our exhibition they're kind of using the cutting edge of this deepfake technology, meaning that it's really indecipherable. And that's really kind of fantastical right now, right? And we're hypothesizing about how that could actually fool someone. But what we are seeing, just I think yesterday, we've seen a number of them during this campaign season, is the inexpensive version of a deep fake, the so-called cheap fake, which is, a video that's simply been cut and edited, or the audio has been changed to change the context of what someone is doing or saying. And I think we just saw one yesterday or the day before where the campaign shared Biden quoting the Pope. I believe wasn't there a video about that that really made it seem like he was totally confused and saying something that he wasn't. So I would argue that we're really already swimming in this water. They're just not all the seamless versions. They're a bit more rudimentary.
How long does the public have to see the exhibition, by the way, Blue?
Through November 14th.
Through November 14th at Roco. So that's kind of the look at the future of this. Let's kind of go back to the past. I want to talk about Octavio's work. It's called A Fake History of Humanity. Blue, first I'll ask you, tell me how it hits you and what you think it will do for the viewing public.
Well, I think Octavio's contribution to this exhibition is perhaps the most beautiful aspect of the show. It's really it's a large monumental painting with multiple panels, and this is Octavio's take on rewriting history as he sees fit. I think within the context of the exhibition, it gives people something to walk through and read at their own pace and experience, and learn a bit about Octavio as he has rewritten history to his liking. And also, it brings a bit of levity to a pretty heavy set of subjects.
Well, let's talk about how it balances some of those themes. Octavio, tell me how it came together and tell me your goals with a fake history of humanity.
The piece was supposed to represent this era we're living in. It's like a monument to lies. So I wanted to, if everyone's lying, if politicians are lying, so, well, I thought to myself, I'm going to lie then too. I'm going to make up a world which I would love, and I would also hate to live in that world where aliens are real, angels are real, homeopathy works, etc. So I decided to pick on all these pseudosciences, religion, beliefs, myth, folklore, etc., and make them real, and make it so in a way that it becomes really, I think, really fast when you're reading the piece, when you're watching the piece, that something is wrong there. So the first encounter you have with the words, you begin to realize there's something wrong, and then it turns out almost everything is a complete lie. So it was my desire to question how we get information, why do we believe the things that we believe in, and who do we trust for the way history is narrated, be it in the form of national identities or worldwide, you know, like main history.
Octavio's A Fake History of Humanity does use those wrong dates, sometimes the wrong name, sometimes something that's wildly, obviously, absurdly something that never happened, sometimes something that might be more believable. I mean, I wonder, Octavio, how many people would believe it if you told them this is the date in history of the slaying of the last unicorn? People might go, oh, I thought there weren't unicorns. I guess I didn't know there used to be unicorns.
Yeah, the reactions we got when the piece was shown at some fairs were like, at first I thought it was real, and then I began to read a little, two or three more, and then I realized it was a lie. So it was fun to have people wondering about how they found out by themselves that it was a lie. And there were people that were like angered, like, no, that's not true. And we were like, of course, that's not true. That's the point.
this is like the dividing line is, if you could drop into a historical timeline, one or two things that are not true that might be believable if there's context of basic truth around it versus in yours. I mean, when you have Kellyanne Conway opened a portal to a parallel dimension on live television, I mean, I do think that that's actually sort of possible and how weird this year has been, but I'm pretty sure that has not happened. So that's when I would start to pick up on it.
Yeah, that was actually the first painting I wrote, the Kellyanne Conway, because it was the first use of the alternative facts and the in television and the media, and it began to represent how the actual U.S. government is acting according to reality, which bothers me greatly, where people can't think that what they say is real because they say it, and that's not the way reality works.
Right, and so let me ask Eric O'Brien about a related theme here. So Octavio's work indicates to us that, I mean, in a somewhat humorous way, that if we're not careful, we start believing things that should be obvious to us that are not true, even the outlandish stuff. But sometimes on a daily basis, it's hard for us to distinguish what's real or not, especially when we have motivated reasoning. And here's an example. Everybody's looking at the presidential polls, Erica. Not everybody. Some people are sane and are much smarter than me and keep themselves away from this stuff. But people like me, I'm always refreshing the polls and checking where things are. Nate Silver at 538 compiles the polls, and he compiles a sort of average of possibilities. And he said the other day that we are close to the point, we are approaching the point where if Joe Biden doesn't win, it was either a case of polling itself is basically lost in the wilderness because it is outdated and it's not doing it right, or some shenanigans happened, that votes were thrown out, not counted, etc. Because the polling is so strong in Biden's favor right now, Silver saying we're close to that point where either polling is just awful and it has to be torn down to the studs and rebuilt, or something unseemly happened. Molly Hemingway from The Federalist, who is a Trump partisan, who appears on Fox News daily, tells her followers that Nate Silver is now telling Democrats that if Trump wins, to protest the election. But that is not what Nate Silver was saying at all. But boy, all of a sudden, 400,000 followers believe it and start disseminating this, and they're going, oh, see, well, now Nate Silver is saying Democrats should march on the White House if Trump wins, which is not what Nate Silver said. It took about 5 minutes for that to spread around the world. And people just trust it. And that's another thing. I mean, I'm sure I do it when I feel a bias, Erica. I'm sure I'm susceptible. I don't know what to do with that. And I'm wondering how you view social media as a tool because of the velocity of information. Octavio can have some fun in his exhibit with making us look and go, wait, were there unicorns? Is that really, was that a thing? But when it's happening in social media, it spreads really, really quickly. And I'm almost to the point where I think we're all going to be healthier if we can pull ourselves away from that stuff more. But I don't really know how to do that. How do you see it?
I think, yes, definitely. The speed at which news is disseminated is so quick. And then the attention that the initial false report gets is so much greater than the attention that any correction or any attempt to insert truth into the situation is just the disparity is really disturbing. And I think that people, I think we're still in sort of the infancy of social media, or maybe, you know, toddlerhood or whatever. But I think that as we go forward, I mean, people are going to have to be, they're going to have to evaluate, or they're going to have to learn how to evaluate what is, what they're seeing on Twitter, or what they're seeing on Facebook, and understand that, that it's not true. I mean, it's not necessarily true. And as far as the fact that we are facing an election and these kinds of things can have sway over who is going to control the country, it's very scary. It's very, very scary. And this is going to be, I think this will be our second election in which social media, I think the Trump, for Trump's first election was the first election in which social media played such an outsized role. And we'll see. I mean, I think it's a pivotal time and it's a very interesting time.
Yeah. Mike on Twitter says the challenge to teaching critical thinking is for everyone, not just kids. Too many people in the age of the internet have either never had or have turned off most of their critical thinking skills. That's from Mike. I sadly agree with that one. Octavio, what are you hoping people end up taking from it? If they go experience a fake history of humanity, we may laugh at a few things, but ultimately, what do you want the viewing public to end up, how do you hope it benefits the viewing public?
I hope that they get at some point mad at me because I'm actually destroying the U.S. at some point. I am destroying many religions, if not all of them, because I wanted to leave no demographic unrepresented respecting them out of fear. I try to pick on everyone. So I hope that challenge their views on what they are actually living now is the result of the long process of history, and I hope that they live doubting everything they read, everything they think they know, because as you just said, we are living in the infancy of social media, and we're going to have to deal with how to balance free expression and truth.
So let me grab a phone call. This is Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The earlier statement that was said about polling, I don't think you can count on polls in a national race like this to any great extent, because I think that the vote for Trump has been driven underground. I don't think people are going to tell a pollster if they're going to vote for him. I think they might go into a voting booth and vote for him, or they might submit a absentee ballot or something like that for him. But we spent 4 years where, you know, there's been all these shows, including your show. I remember the one you had on women who voted for Trump, mm-hmm. and it was like 1 hour of vote shaming. I think that behavior has driven people underground. They're not going to tell you who they're really going to vote for.
All right. Well, I want to ask you briefly about that, Robert. I mean, when it comes to the president's supporters, if they're so unwilling to tell pollsters how they're going to vote, why are they so willing to tell the New York Times and the Washington Post? We have more pieces in the last 4 years than we can ever count about Trump voters, why they voted for Trump. Are they still voting for Trump? If they lost a job, are they voting for Trump? Did their parents vote for Trump? Are their kids going to vote for Trump? Did they bake a cake with the president's face on it? They're more than willing to share all of that. But you're saying when the pollster calls, they just won't tell them?
They won't take the call.
They won't take the call. Okay. It is definitely possible. Thank you, Robert. It is definitely possible that Robert's right. I will point out that 4 years ago, the polls weren't that far off. The national polling was pretty close to right. And then the swing states that ended up going for Trump very closely were within the margin of error. They just happened to swing from blue to red and within that margin. And maybe for the reason Robert says, it is definitely possible. I don't think anybody has any clue what's going to happen next Tuesday. And I think it is wise to heed Robert's point that if you trust the polls, you may end up being disappointed, whether you favor the president, whether you favor Joe Biden, whether you favor anybody else. So I appreciate that, Robert. Thank you. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk more about what's going on at ROCO. And we're talking about news, information, the state of reality, how we see our world, how vulnerable we are to misrepresentations, whether it is misinformation that's intentional, whether it's information that's out of context, whether it's deep fakes. Different artists are taking their own sort of shots at what that has done to us, past, present, and future. And ROCO is putting it on full display, and we're right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. The exit from the American workforce this year has been massive with the pandemic, especially for women. Disproportionate numbers of women knocked out of the workforce. What does this mean, and what happens next? We'll talk about it first hour. Then in our second hour, a lot going on with social media policy, from Twitter blocking stories from the New York Post to questions about privacy and more. We'll talk about it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you're just joining us, Blue Cease is the curator and executive director of the Rochester Contemporary Arts Center. Blue, remind listeners what's going on at ROCO and how it relates to what we're talking about here.
We have an exhibition on called Trust But Verify, and there are three larger projects in the exhibition representing a triad of past, present, and future, and all the projects are addressing through the artists different approaches and media, addressing our societal grappling with truth and veracity and accuracy, and our website is rochestercontemporary.org, as always.
All right. I want to bring in Eric Koonsman, who is an artist, who has got an exhibit called Fake News. And Blue, I'll start with you here. What do you think viewers and the audience is going to get out of fake news?
I think first and foremost, they're going to say, oh, my God, look what this artist did. This is incredible. I've heard countless people who visited us say something along those lines. Eric has created this incredible archive, which is both I think right on point and also kind of off trend. He has attempted to document the Trump presidency through news headlines. And there are actually screenshots of major media outlets, homepage on his phone. And he's done that, daily for the last 4 years. It's still ongoing. I'm sure he can give us an update on how it's going right now, but they're presented in the gallery as five massive bound volumes that are proceeding sequentially around the space, each page representing one day's worth of headlines. Of course, headlines move really quickly, but Eric has captured a snapshot in a screenshot of our current news moment on that day.
So, Eric, take us back to how the idea for this began to germinate with you.
It was really meant for my son. My son, during the last election, was in first grade at Cobbles Elementary School in Penfield. And he came home one day and he told us they're going to run a mock election. And we said, why? We said, well, the kids on the playground, we're not playing kickball or soccer anymore. We're debating about Hillary versus Trump. I'm like, wait a minute, you guys are in first grade. And so we finally asked my son, who are you going to vote for? And he said, Trump, because Hillary's going to make China great again. And we're like, wait a minute, that sounded way too familiar. And the following Sunday during the Philadelphia Eagles game, which we were watching, the commercial came on, which shaped my son's opinion, which was a black and white, it was a very stark, dark commercial. And so that's when I realized, you know, so we had to actually talk to a six-year-old about politics. because of what he was seeing on the TV. So after the election, everything that happened, I decided, you know what, I wanted to start recording the major news to show him. And it started out with CNN at first because that's what was being attacked. And then I quickly moved to having a much broader perspective. So it was CNN, ABC News, Fox News, New York Times, Washington Post, and Huffington Post, which I've been capturing daily. And it was really never meant to be an art project. At first, it was just supposed to be something I could show my son and now my daughter when they're older what happened during this time, because I was afraid of what they might hear from everybody else via social media and other news sources.
What did you see in your son as you tried to kind of teach this lesson? How did he take it?
It was really meant to be. At first, I just started showing some of the headlines, and he said, "So, but that's not what I see on TV." And that's where we're just really trying to shape, not try to push him left or right in any way, just try to make him understand that sometimes what we're seeing on TV or even the internet, because even on his iPad, things would pop up, just really help him to realize that not everything he sees is true, is really what I was trying. And he started to realize that and understand how there are different opinions. Because he would get the opposite opinions between his grandparents. One's more left-leaning, the other is very right-leaning. And that's where he was able to see that.
Interesting. And one of the examples in your volumes of books that demonstrate the different media headlines on any given day. So April 15th, 2019 was the day that Notre Dame Cathedral in France burned. What did you notice then?
That was a day that definitely stood out to me because every news channel except Fox News was talking about Notre Dame, and Fox was talking about Bernie Sanders of all things. And it was just defamation of character at the time. And that was one where that's what, when you're looking at these volumes, you start to really see the events more so than which one is right, which one's wrong, because they're all, you know, have their own perspectives. And that's why on that particular day, seeing Notre Dame, I thought everybody would want to be talking about that at that time.
Instead, what you saw was, what, an addiction to politics that trumps even the reporting of news that would seem apolitical?
That's what you would believe. That's where it was such an international event that I would assume everybody would have been reporting on Notre Dame. But it was simply, it was politics. Just another political day, unfortunately, for Fox at that time.
Mm. Erica Bryant, as a journalist, you know, when you see polling of Americans, especially as we get closer to elections, Americans like to say things like, I'm sick of politics, I want politics out. Yet the biggest ratings go to the shows that are, you know, sort of addicted to politics in this way. And I wonder if it is sort of an addiction or what it is that we could do to sort of rest ourselves from that, because Americans will say they don't want everything to be political. Not every story should have a tinge of politics. Is that naive, or do you think that the media should respond to some of what Americans claim in that kind of polling?
I think that the media should cover stories in an in-depth sort of way. I think the problem when people say they're sick of politics, they're sick of sort of mudslinging,
cable newsy politics,
salacious,
yep,
politics where it's people shouting at each other or being disrespectful to each other or making claims that aren't true. And so do I think that we should have fewer of those kind of stories? Absolutely. I think that we definitely need more in-depth analysis of how political actors shape issues that really impact our lives, because that's important. And the stories that about, I don't know, for example, environmental changes that have happened or things like that, they just don't get the same kind of attention that you'll get from sort of a misinterpretation of a misquote of some politician that's running for something. And so I think we definitely need more depth and less of the sort of shallow mudslinging kind of carnival type of political coverage.
Mm. Eric, do you think seeing the collection of headlines in the way that you've put it together, is it enough to sort of shake people and make your audience think maybe differently about how they're consuming news and information?
Absolutely. because we have become such a headline society. The perfect example of this is my father-in-law, who is all he does is watch Fox News. And I knew this project was going to work last Christmas Eve when I accidentally left the books out and he discovered them. And he started flipping through. And I mean, all he watches, I can say, is Fox News. And when he flipped through, he goes, "Oh, wow, look at this. This is really great. You look at the events." He goes, and at first he joked around. He goes, "Oh, look, Fox is right. And CNN did this." But for an 85-year-old Italian immigrant to see that for me really helped me to realize that, you know, people can put their bias down for a moment when they see all five or six presented on the same page. It becomes about the events, and that's where discussions can actually start.
Hmm. How powerful is it, Blue? What have you seen with it?
I think it's powerful both in its scale and its scope, and also in the way that Eric is describing the simple, straightforward presentation of a visual comparison of many or several media outlets on one page. Not only is it, I think, an important document right now, but I think, you know, one part of this project, as I understand Eric's long-term intention, is to, you know, archive these with significant archives and museums and libraries. This really isn't a fine art product that someone would necessarily, you know, purchase to have on their coffee table. This is really about documenting this for years for posterity. There's another thing I'd love to mention.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned that the project is titled Fake News, and, you know, Eric has sort of neutrally repurposed, perhaps, that phrase. Or started off, kicked off this monumental effort with that phrase, fake news. And I wanted to just sort of close the loop on that. I know that Erica has a couple stories of how that phrase has become a incredibly loaded weapon.
Yeah, it is weaponized.
It's been weaponized, exactly. And it's really taken the place of and can easily remove an attention to actual verifiable fact once this all-important claim is made that something is fake news.
Erica, can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So after the Trump election, I was a reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle, and I noticed that people would start, you know, throwing, whenever they didn't like your article, they would throw the term fake news at it, but it didn't have weren't using the meaning of fake to mean not factual or not true or false, or they would accept the information in your article as true, but they would still call it fake news. And I thought that was, it took me a while to sort of process what was happening, but I came to understand that basically people were saying that fake news was anything that didn't sort of match up with the way that they wanted to see the world or that they wanted to look at things. So I'll give you an example. One time I wrote a story about a deportation that had happened where a man was, he had grown up in Rochester since he was 8 years old, but he was born in Haiti. And then he had, when he was like 30 or something, he had a criminal conviction. And because he wasn't an American citizen, he was deported. So he was sent to a country that he didn't remember and didn't speak the language. And so I wrote this up and somebody sends a note saying fake news because this man was a criminal. And it's like, it's not fake. I'm the one that told you that fact that the gentleman had been convicted of a crime. So what he was saying to me was that he just didn't like the way or the information that I had given. And it didn't sort of fit into his way that he wants immigrants to be seen. And so I think now basically people are just throwing fake news at any story that they don't like without any sort of connection to whether or not they believe it's true or not.
Well, and let me just ask you a little bit about headlines before I grab another phone call, because Eric Koonsman is, you know, making the point that so much of what we see is really just the headlines or maybe a very little past that.
Oh, I can talk about, I mean, sorry, you finish your question.
Oh, no.
About headlines.
did I spark something there?
Oh, yes. And also, I would say in the last, 4 years or so, or maybe even a little bit before that, you would get emails from people where it was completely clear that they had not read your story,
yep,
that they had only seen the headline.
Yep. Yep, and I'm sure you as a journalist have dealt with that so often, or people are commenting, how dare you say this or report this, and then you realize they have no clue what they're talking about. But what I want to ask you, though, Erica, I mean, like, I share this goal of getting people to read beyond the headline, to actually read the article. I share what should be a national movement of do not forward, email, post, retweet, send, or otherwise share any article that you haven't read. I think that's a great rule of thumb. But Twitter now, Erica, if you try to share something that you haven't actually clicked on, in other words, if you want to just retweet somebody else's, if there's a headline embedded in somebody else's story, but you haven't clicked it yourself, at least through that application, Twitter has this little thing now where they ask you, you sure you want to share this yet? You know, there's more than just the headline. And it almost feels a little paternalistic. It almost feels a little condescending. You know, like, hello, small-minded person. Are you sure you want to do this? I kind of like it, but I kind of think it's a little condescending, and I wonder how you feel.
I think it's just Twitter's effort to stop being involved in all of this dissemination
yes.
of misinformation. Basically, I'm somebody up there is feeling guilty. They're like, we're, you know, destroying American democracy. No, I don't mean that. I don't hold Twitter at fault for what we are seeing, but just they don't want to be responsible for the dissemination of all these lies. And so I guess that's just their effort.
Yeah. Eric Koonsman, how do you see that?
I think that's where, that's why I want to make sure I showed just the headlines, because that's oftentimes all that we are reading.
Yep.
And that's why the comparison really helps. So if you see a headline from CNN, which is kind of misconstrued, well, then you have ABC, Washington Post, and New York Times, where it's downplayed a little bit. And then you have Fox's. And that's what really helps to see those events. And that's why it is unfortunate that I only have the headlines. But for copyright reasons, I did not want to put the full stories in there. And also, it's already 4,000 pages. so that's one of the reasons. But and that's where, like I said, the headlines, we only do get part of the story. And that's why having all the different news channels is so important.
It's a really smart idea for an art piece, Erica. Let me grab a phone call. This is Jim in Irondequoit. Hi, Jim.
Howdy. Is it safe for me to assume that everyone here would say that people that believe that Pizzagate is real or the Sandy Hook shooting was faked or 9/11 truth people, is it safe to assume that if those people are victims of false information, misinformation?
I think often, I mean, I all three of those are all different ideas. You know,
right. But the phrases that you guys are using are always used in reference to people that believe in those things. So I'm just asking what I think is a simple question, I guess. I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, Eric O'Brien, how do you see? I mean, if people believe that Pizzagate is real, what were the others that, Jim, you mentioned? Pizzagate?
9/11 truth, Sandy Hook.
Sandy Hook was,
you know,
faked.
Those things.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, that kind of stuff. They're okay. Victims of misinformation.
Erica, would you say people who believe that are victims of misinformation?
Well, let's take Sandy Hook. Yes, I do believe that people who believe that Sandy Gate is a hoax are victims of misinformation.
Okay. Can I ask just one more question?
I don't think that do I think most of them are victims of misinformation, or do I think that they are sort of looking for some way to
same thing you said before, they verify their viewpoint?
Right, to sort of
right.
justify a certain viewpoint.
Have you yourself or any of the people on here studied either any of these subjects for yourselves in depth?
Sure. Sandy Hook, especially, sure.
Yeah,
I've interviewed parents who've lost children at Sandy Hook. Yeah,
I know that. I'm saying from a critical perspective. You were talking about critical thinking earlier, how important it is to maintain that. So I'm asking if you've studied these things from a critical standpoint rather than the narrative standpoint.
Well, what would that entail in your mind, Jim? What would study from a critical standpoint entail?
To be sure that you take in all information from all sides.
Right. I mean, we've got the video, the pictures from the school. We have the tragic and heartbreaking death reports of more than 20 kids. We've got interviews with their families. I guess I'm looking for something that would tell me that there is some kind of counterbalance there that would lead me to be open to the idea that no children died at Sandy Hook.
Are you aware of who Wolfgang Helbig is?
No.
Well, if you did study something like this in depth, you would know that immediately. So I feel bad that you aren't aware of alternate information that you're not getting through mainstream sources, because you do put yourself forward, as most guests do on here, as being progressive, forward, critical thinkers, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm doing is what I really don't want to be doing, and it's exposing the hypocrisy going on here and trying to say that the narrative of these things is assumed to be correct, and those that question it or believe otherwise are victims of misinformation, and they couldn't possibly be serious scholars.
Okay. So let me respond to that, Jim, and I always appreciate the call. First of all, there are some conspiracies that ended up being real things that happened. I mean, there are conspiracies in the world. They're not all just conspiracy theories. Sometimes it has happened. I'm trying to be courteous, and I'll respond to emails if you want to follow up, Jim. But we can't be living in a society when kids get shot in school and we tell the parents who lost their kids that it didn't happen. We got to be very careful. I mean, a man in Florida known for denying the Sandy Hook school massacres was harassing these families and was arrested, understandably so. I mean, these families are grieving. Those are real people, real kids who were lost. But I hear you, Jim, when you say we're told to be skeptical, to be open-minded. I think there have to be I'm trying to be kind here. I mean, Erica Bryant, you want to elaborate on how you view how we take skepticism and then draw a line and say, okay, well, we know certain things are true. I mean, there was not a basement in that pizza house where kids were being abused. That was not a thing. That was not real.
In this case, I think the vast majority of people accept the reality of Sandy Hook. I think there's a sort of fringe element of folks that choose not to believe in it, and that's life. I think that there's the greater, I think there's a couple people that are thinking about those types of things, but I think the greater problem is that there is a sort of movement away from being able to believe what you see, or even taking the time to try to figure out whether or not you should believe it on normal stories. Even like this, most people would say, oh, this is a complete fringe. To deny Sandy Hook is a complete fringe position. But I think for some of the more central news stories or central matters, that we also are having people sort of not knowing what to trust or not even trying to figure out.
Yeah, and maybe that's at the core of everything we've been talking about this hour and what Rocco has put together. So, Blue,
I wanted to say,
yeah, that, please.
You know, it's pretty remarkable, and I would kind of want to thank the caller actually for pointing out exactly how we can have such disparate positions on something that both sides believe is clear and obvious, and really two versions of reality. And I really want to encourage all listeners to watch the film The Social Dilemma. It's on Netflix now, it's pretty new, but it touches on the role that social media is playing in creating these echo chambers and really creating our own little reality of our own truths in this so-called post-truth era. I wanted to also respond to the word victim in what the caller said. I personally wouldn't subscribe to that. I think a lot of people who are pointing out and dealing with and trying to address this dissolving of truth, of verifiable truth, aren't calling anyone victims. I think some of the the first people who started to really identify the, quote, post-truth era are really pointing out that there's a real willingness and an embrace of an alternate version of history or of a current event. It's not so much that someone is being tricked. The post-truth era is one where people are willingly heading down a alternate path.
All right, Blue. So remind listeners what they can see and until when.
The exhibition is called Trust But Verify, and there are three big projects in the exhibition: Past, Present, and Future of Our Grappling with Truth and Accuracy. And the exhibition runs through November 14th.
At Rochester Contemporary Arts Center. Blue is the curator and executive director. Thanks for being with us and discussing these issues, especially 6 days before a national election. Thank you, Blue.
Thank you.
Eric Koonsman, fascinating work. Thanks for taking the time to tell us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Octavio Abunda, same. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, everyone appearing on the show.
You got it. Erica Bryant, it's so good to talk to you. Thank you, and thanks for sharing your expertise as well.
Thanks. Take care.
You got it. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a peaceful afternoon, and we will talk with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.